South Korea's request. The U.S. and South Korea seem to have agreed to raise the tension on the Korean Peninsula in an attempt to somehow force North Korea into negotiations on arms control or denuclearization. This reverses the policy of the previous South Korean government that brought about a reduction in tension through engagement and dialogue. Local analysts warn of potential conflict.
When North Korea does something, the South Korea-U.S. alliance reacts. And if the South Korea-U.S. alliance does something, North Korea reacts. And this vicious cycle continues. The stronger the deployment of U.S. strategic assets, the more fragile the peace on the Korean Peninsula, and the faster the arms race. And this risks creating a security dilemma, and more seriously, a war crisis.
More regional tension seems inevitable as South Korea seeks to celebrate the 70th anniversary of its alliance with the U.S. with ever larger war games. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Tensions are flaring up again across the Palestinian territories as the Israeli regime has intensified its bloody crackdown there. After a day of mayhem and bloodshed in the West Bank by the regime's forces, Israeli warplanes rained down missiles on the besieged Gaza Strip, prompting Palestinians to hit back with rockets.
Wednesday's Israeli raid on West Bank was the deadliest in about two decades. Nearly a dozen people were killed and scores more were injured after the regime's forces, backed by armored vehicles, surrounded the city of Nablus and opened fire on the people, including teenagers and elderly. Thousands of Palestinians gathered to mourn the death of their loved ones. Nablus and the nearby city of Jenin have repeatedly come under Israeli attacks over the last couple of months. Palestinians find themselves helpless in front of the occupying regime and its ruthless agenda.
What is happening on the ground is organized state terrorism, which the Israeli occupation government is solely responsible for. The international silence regarding these crimes is an encouragement for the occupation.
Many believe that the inaction of the UN and other international bodies, as well as unwavering support of certain governments for Israel, emboldens the regime to go ahead with its crimes against Palestinians. In doing Israeli crimes over the past several decades, Palestinians have realized that they cannot expect more than condemnation of Israel from the international community.
The right response to Israel is the activation of resistance across the occupied territories and retaliatory attacks against the regime's forces and settlers.
The Israeli regime has piled up pressure on Palestinians with deadly crackdown, illegal detention, and demolition of their homes. Years of crippling siege of the Gaza Strip is yet another example how the regime has turned the Palestinian territory into an open prison. The people in Gaza and the West Bank have been living in fear and agony as they lose their loved ones almost on a daily basis. But Israel's Western and regional backers keep watching the regime's bloodshed silently.
The cortege makes its way down the street into Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery in Tehran. Mourners looking on solemnly as the casket is brought to the burial ground for the funeral prayers to be performed. Right before the body of Salah al-Zawawi, the former Palestinian ambassador to Iran, is laid to rest. Representatives from foreign missions in Tehran, as well as a group of government officials and pro-Palestinian NGO and human rights activists, it was his wish to be buried in Iran, and the chief mourner, his daughter Salam al-Zawawi, who replaced him as the Palestinian ambassador last year, made a powerful statement.
Jerusalem al-Quds will be free. This is what my father truly believed, and he dedicated his life to fighting against the occupiers of our land. As his final wish, he called on all Muslims around the world to help free Jerusalem al-Quds.
Al-Zawawi served as a Palestinian ambassador to Tehran for 42 years, from 1980 to 2022. He retired in February last year due to his failing health. He was the second Palestinian envoy to Iran after the revolution, succeeding Hani al-Hassan. As the longest-serving foreign diplomat in the Islamic Republic, he earned the title Muqaddam al-Sufara, which means the senior most foreign diplomat.
He was a committed diplomat and truly believed in the unity of all Palestinians. He worked very hard to make that happen. Al-Zawawi would attend every single event where there was a possibility of discussing the situation of Palestine and shedding light on the atrocities of the Zionist regime. During his tenure in Tehran, he also played an important role as diplomat. We have lost a very good friend.
During his years-long battle against the Zionist occupiers of Palestine and several decades of diplomatic activities in Iran, Zawawi always fought to safeguard the rights of oppressed Palestinians and keep the Palestinian cause alive.
According to all of our agreements, we are completely against normalizing ties with Israel. This is something that Mr. Al-Zawawi stood up for. He made a lot of speeches discussing why it's absolutely wrong to normalize ties with Israeli occupiers of our land.
The late Salah Al-Zawawi was like a father to all of us in the resistance front. He dedicated his life to uniting Palestinians and fighting for the freedom of our land. He wanted every single inch of Palestine to be free. May he rest in peace.
I met Mr. Al-Zawawi 3 years ago when I first arrived in Tehran to serve as Syria's ambassador. But I knew him long before that. In Syria, he was a very well-known figure because of his political views and speeches. Not only did he advocate Palestinian rights, but he also played an important role in strengthening the ties of Arab countries.
To many people, Salah al-Zawawi was an icon, a role model. But to his family, he was a loving father and grandfather, too.
My grandfather was not just a leader and an ambassador. He wasn't just great at his job. He was a great person at home with his family. He was a great father, he was a great grandfather, and he was a great friend. He will be missed because, honestly, his presence was such a great influence for all of us. He was lovely, he was funny, he was motivational, and he was strong.
Throughout his career, Salah al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, efforts that, according to him, had eventually made a point with the occupiers.
It is very clear to them that the people of Palestine will never forget its land. Not in 1948 and in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and 1948, we will never forget our land.
This is probably why Palestinians of all backgrounds take his loss heavily.
Salah al-Zawawi served as a Palestinian ambassador to Tehran for more than four decades. He was the second Palestinian ambassador since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. He was also among the founding members of the Fatah movement. He will always be remembered as an influential figure in the fight against Israeli occupation. Gisum Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
The UN Special Envoy to Yemen, Haynes Grunberg, has been busy this week meeting with Yemeni and UAE officials in the Emirates. The UN Envoy's office posted a tweet stating that the latest efforts are aimed at improving Yemen's living conditions and securing longer-term peace, security, and development. Given the UN's track record in Yemen, it behooves one to raise some questions about what security, peace, and development look like through the political lens of the United Nations. I visited Mohammed al-Nu'aymi, a member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, to hear his take on the UN's progress in establishing security, lasting peace, and development in Yemen.
The United Nations efforts and strategies in most of the nations they have been involved in have focused on two main efforts. The first effort is gathering intelligence for Western nations because it is the West who controls the UN. The second effort is to pave the way for Western states to implement their political agenda. For example, in Yemen, they want to control the country's political affairs and geography. If they are unable to achieve this, their second option is to divide Yemen.
Al-Nu'aymi also said The UN and its partners' political ambitions are not limited to Yemen.
They are not just planning to divide Yemen. They are planning to fragmentize the entire region, including the states that are helping them in this effort. For example, they are planning to divide Egypt into three states and Saudi Arabia into five states.
Abdel Khalik Qobar, a Yemeni judge I spoke with, said cases of war crimes should be filed against members of the United Nations, who he says are actively engaged in covering up the crimes against humanity perpetuated on Yemenis. In his televised speech last week, leader of Ansar Allah movement Sayyid Abdel Malik al-Houthi called on the Yemeni people to be prepared for war in case peaceful efforts fail to bring about the Yemeni people's demands.
The UN claims to be engaged in peaceful efforts to bring an end to the conflict in Yemen. However, according to Ansar Allah officials, the UN body has been engaged in efforts to divide countries in the region. Officials we spoke with believe this is part of a greater plan which aims to prevent the Muslim world from uniting against Western imperialism. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Bringing currency volatility under control is the name of the game for the new governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, who is charged with getting a grip on the Iranian rial and devising new strategies to alleviate the country's economic woes amid unprecedented Western sanctions. And to do so, he has unveiled a new golden currency exchange center in an effort to regulate market fluctuations, or in his own words, stabilize market rates by adjusting demand and supply. But most importantly, as a powerful tool to control speculative inflation. For those familiar with Iran's economy, the most essential economic parameter that can effectively tip the scales.
We have enough resources to provide for all demands for exchange. The main challenge we are facing is speculative inflation as a consequence of negative forecasts, which leads to producers increasing the price of commodities and therefore creates a vicious circle. We need to overcome this challenge, and I'm calling on all those involved in economic activities to join hands with us and strictly follow the new policies of this newly launched center of exchange.
This means that all foreign exchange resources, notably from export, must be supervised by the central bank.
The 28,500 toman exchange rate for basic commodities and essential medicines still stands. Other demands for foreign currencies have been carefully categorized, and in the first leg, we are allocating $4 million to specific purposes, which include travel, studying abroad, and research projects, the details of which will be announced shortly.
This is actually a policy that has been successfully implemented by Russia and allowed the ruble to recover its value within a month after its initial plunge at the beginning of the Ukraine war.
Russia's success in implementing this policy is mostly due to their system of financial supervision, which ensures that regulatory rules are strictly observed. There are major differences between the economic and monetary structures and approaches of Iran and Russia. And if Iran wants to succeed, it has to take all this into account.
And the good news is, if this policy is successfully implemented, the recovery of the rial is imminent in a situation very similar to what happened in Russia.
Russia's national currency is gaining strength. The ruble is hitting new highs against the U.S. dollar. The Russian economy is making a turnaround despite unprecedented Western sanctions and pressure. Now Iran, taking Russia as a role model, is hoping to do the same. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
This one lay. Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another missile test by North Korea. Four long-range cruise missiles were fired. A repeated scenario in response to U.S. joint war games. But is this time different? North Korea says it is. And the U.S. and its regional allies believe these missiles are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. In this edition of the program, we will look at why the U.S. is ramping up military pressure instead of diplomatic overtures on Pyongyang, and why it is content in doing that, knowing that North Korean missiles are capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. William Jones from the Executive Intelligence Review joins us from Leesburg. Jim Cavan, a political analyst and blogger, joins us from New York.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. And William Jones, let me first start with you. First, get your reaction on the missiles that were fired. We're looking at four long-range cruise missiles. The question is whether this time is different based on how the capabilities, as it was reported, it said these were strategic cruise missiles designed to demonstrate its ability to conduct a nuclear counterattack, the key word being counterattack here, I think. So do you deem this to be different than the previous missile launches?
Well, they're obviously improving their capabilities here. Reports have it that some of the missiles had made a oval and even a double eight maneuver, showing that there is greater maneuverability in these missiles. And, of course, they're reaching now to almost 2,000 kilometers. It's really a serious upgrade on the part of North Korea. And as the situation becomes more tense, directly after the maneuvers between Japan, South Korea, and the U.S., where the U.S. is doing significant upgrading in the Asia-Pacific region generally, aimed at North Korea, but also against China, this has created a great deal of tension where the North Koreans typically react by trying to show some of their capabilities. So I think There is an increased tension, there's increased capability in, that North Korea is now showing. But I think they're doing it in a context in which the tensions are being fed by U.S. policy in the region, which is increasingly more pushing the military rather than diplomatic solution to the problem, especially the problems with the DPRK.
So you're seeing a relationship there between the U.S. militaristic approach towards the region and the number of missiles or the times the missiles are being launched by North Korea?
Well, sure, I'm sure they are trying to utilize the maximum capability that they actually have there. I think this probably would not have occurred had the maneuvers not taken place. And the maneuvers, of course, are directly aimed at, okay, at North Korea and have been criticized by North Korea prior to their being held in the area, so that it was a direct affront. I think they felt to their attempt to maintain some kind of stability in the region. And they're reacting in the way that DPR always reacts.
Jim Kavanaugh, taking a look at the joint war games that was reported on this between the U.S. and South Korea, what was different about this is the fact that it was held in Washington. They called it a tabletop exercise, which focused on, I guess, hypothetical scenarios of which North Korea would use nuclear weapons. And this was the first of its sort under the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol. What is that indicative of, or what does that show, that it was practiced in the U.S.?
I'm not sure that shows very much. The United States and South Korea have engaged in real military exercises, and that's what really annoys the North Koreans. It was a tabletop exercise in Washington. Of course, it's presented as a defensive exercise, but of course, even in the middle of a defensive exercise, they're going to plan for an invasion of North Korea, and North Korea knows that. So it's just a fact of the military cooperation and the tight military cooperation between South Korea and the United States going to Washington to do these exercises that has North Korea on edge. Look, everybody has to understand the history of the Korean War, which is kind of a forgotten war. That was a vicious war. The United States bombed North Korea to rubble, and they did that to prevent the unification of the peninsula under the forces that had fought the Japanese, which was a vicious Japanese occupation, and they did that in support of a dictatorial regime in the south, which was composed of people who had collaborated with the Japanese. So the North Koreans have a history. They know, they have a historical memory of what it means for the United States to attack them. And that's why they're on edge all the time about this. So, you know, they're never going to stop being on edge about South Korean, United States military exercises and military cooperation and building up forces. And now the United States is building up Japan again to be Joe Biden vowed to make Japan a potent military force. You know, again, the Japanese occupation of Korea was vicious. So the North Koreans have a historical memory that most people in the West, you know, the Korean War was glossed over in our history, and not for them. So they remember this, and they're going to be on edge about any American military exercises in the region. And they know what's going on with China and Taiwan. They know that even NATO has said, we've got to extend our reach into the Pacific. For some reason, the Pacific's part of the North Atlantic now. So there's a world situation, and in that area too, which is on the edge of conflict. Sure. And the Americans seem to be ready for conflict everywhere, and the North Koreans are aware of that.
There's a number of points that you raised there. Before we get to those points, however, I got to find out whether we can zoom in, William Jones, on who goes first. Trying to figure this out based on the way things are being reported. I mentioned what's happening in the States with this tabletop exercises, but this is an exercise held where the U.S. has announced that this is being done because of a potential nuclear strike by North Korea. Okay? They're looking at it that way. But the North's posturing is one of counterattack, meaning the U.S. or its allies would attack first. Is that accurate reading it that way? And then there's this the fact that this does not read with how each stands in terms of attacking first, because each thinks the other is going to attack first.
Well, I think that's probably they would be wary of trying to start a nuclear conflict with the United States of their own volition. Since they realize there's going to be perhaps a destruction of the nation. But they must have that capability. The reason they're going with a nuclear, becoming a nuclear power, effectively becoming a nuclear power, is that they feel that there's no other option open to them, that the opposition of the United States to the DPRK has been pretty straightforward through the years. The only exception was when President Trump successfully conducted negotiations with North Korea. People felt that it could be resolved diplomatically. But he was heavily criticized by the military-industrial complex while he was still president, while this was still ongoing. And then afterwards, of course, has been totally rejected by the Biden administration, which feels that only a policy of showing force, peace through strength, can make any headway with regard to mm-hmm. the DPR. And of course, that causes the major conflict, so that they see these as the nuclear capability that they have as a capability of being able to fend off and to respond to a possible nuclear attack from the West. But they do it by showing what they can do, because words are not going to convince anybody in the U.S. military-industrial complex that North Korea is not a threat, unless it shows that it is. And this is why they're very demonstrative in showing the weapons, rather than pursuing an aggressive policy. They want to show that we can respond, okay. and you should do this with some respect, and you should try and come to some kind of a negotiated position with us. But at this point, it just has not succeeded because of the tremendous opposition to the United States of diplomacy in the DPRK-U.S. relationship.
So your guess, yes or no answer, if I may ask you that, William Jones, based on how you see it, if the situation continues this way, who would strike first?
Well, I do not think that the DPRK would make any first strike unless they were significantly threatened, or they felt that they were significantly threatened.
Well, they're feeling that right now, right?
Well, that's a real question. What is the red line here? I mean,
I tell you why they're feeling that. Let me just throw this stat out there. You have all the different missile tests that have happened. I'm going to address Jim Kavanaugh with this. Jim Kavanaugh, you have all these missile tests that North Korea has executed throughout the years, and then boom, 2020. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't use that word. Then you have the year 2022, and you have 72 of them. You had 22 missile tests in a span of 3 days. I think they're feeling threatened, or they're trying to say something. What do you think? What do you make of that? And this happening during the tenure of the current U.S. President Joe Biden.
Well, I think they are trying to demonstrate that if we get hit, we can impose serious damage on those who come after us. Look, they have certain problems with this. They did demonstrate some maneuvering capabilities with these cruise missiles, but they're still saying they're not yet capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles they have are still liquid fuel missiles, which means they cannot be readied very quickly. The United States knows what's happening there. If North Korea were to start fueling up their ICBMs for an attack on someone, the United States would know it.
Can
so
they?
I think so, probably, because they're liquid-fueled missiles. They require preparation. They
so
can't be
why,
easily
so
moved
then why
around.
So why not push for some kind of diplomatic move, something, a concession maybe of some kind? I'm guessing when you have missiles that can reach the U.S. mainland, and you say that maybe it could be capable of nuclear warhead, which the reading was by the U.S., that this is a rehearsal for developing nuclear warheads or putting nuclear warheads on it, you would guess there'd be some kind of diplomatic overture. Why isn't there one?
Well, I don't think is the American administration ready to have a diplomatic overture
Why
with North Korea?
They?
Because it doesn't want to. They could put in this. The Korean War is still going on. There's no peace treaty.
William Jones, what do you
the
think?
United
Hold
States
on.
Doesn't want
William
to put
Jones,
it
let me get
it.
William
Donald
Jones an answer on this. I'm sorry, Jim Kavanaugh. William Jones, why not?
Nobody can say for sure what the North Korean leadership's decisions will be in this. There's a lot of erratic movement. There's a lot of irrationalism. However, I think it's quite clear to them that if they would launch a strike against the United States, or even a strike against the United States facilities like in Guam, or perhaps even a strike against Japan, there would probably be an overwhelming reaction by U.S. nuclear forces, which would essentially end the North Korean state entirely. I think there's a certain understanding of that. And therefore, I think that they would be very reticent in starting that fight. But at the same time, they want to have the capability for a variety of reasons, for defense reasons, but also in terms of the political influence that being a nuclear power has in the world. which they also want to attain. But I think short of that, I think that if they launched an attack, it would be like a hand grenade that would be set off in North Korea itself, ending the North Korean state. I don't think the North Korean leadership, as mercurial as they are, is totally insane on this issue.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right. Well, you both have mentioned Japan on a couple of occasions now, so let's look at the military defense budget. It has been raised by 26%. That's the largest. What does that mean when it comes to what Jim Kavanaugh, what you said? You said that the U.S. is going to be pumping them up with arms. First of all, does Japan want to really get in on this with the U.S.? Is Japan acting on its own free will when it comes to the way that it stands with North Korea?
Well, I think there are political factions in Japan that want to rearm, that would like Japan to become a potent military force, quote unquote, in the region again. And they are de facto, the United States is promoting that and doing that, and they will do it. Now, it's not just in relation to Korea, but it's in relation to the region as a whole. And, you know, again, it is very, the peculiarity of the North Korean situation is unique. And again, Japan's relationship with Korea is terrible. And historically, you know, I don't think they're looking to reinvade and reoccupy Korea, but they are part of the American hegemonic domination of the Pacific region. And that's what they've thrown in their lot, like Europe has thrown in its lot, Western Europe and Eastern Europe with the United States and Europe. Japanese have thrown in their lot with the Americans, and we are going to be part of your hegemonic program in the Pacific region, which means we're going to support whatever you do in China and whatever you do in North Korea.
Okay, since you mentioned China, need to ask you about that, Bill Jones. What is the relationship between China and North Korea?
The relationship is still a friendly relationship. I don't think they have control over what North Koreans do. They have some influence, but I think they're also very wary and uncertain about where that's going. They would like to have a diplomatic resolution to the nuclear issue. They do want a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. They would like to see this moving forward, but they are not the chief players there. And as long as there is no indication from the United States to achieve such a solution, they have very little they can do. The issue of North Korea, of course, is also, in one sense, defensive for them, because the fact that the North Koreans are there as a former ally and still a very good friend, a lot of trade relations between the two, this is also preserves a buffer in many respects against Japan in particular, which is becoming more hostile, at least in the defense area. And even South Korea, which still maintains very good relationships with China, but is also being wooed by the United States to join in some kind of alliance, perhaps of a military character, aimed against China. So the China's position is that they would like to see a stable DPRK. They would like to see some kind of diplomatic solution to this. They would use their influence, I believe, if the United States were willing to move in that direction, But they do not want a military conflict on the Korean Peninsula, okay, because this would be very disastrous.
Jim Cavanaugh, I asked you about the number of missile launches that North Korea did in the year 2022, which was the most, 70, compared to the previous years. Now, there's one theory that says North Korea has upped its number of missile exercises because it's also wanting to send a message, but not of the direct kind to the U.S., because it shows that what the U.S. intentions in the region are, aside from doing something about North Korea, is to target China. So with these exercises increasing to the point that it has, this may make the U.S. think twice about a military engagement in the region. Do you think that's the type of message that North Korea has sent to the U.S.? Does the U.S. see it that way?
Well, I'm sure the U.S. does see it that way, in the sense that the U.S. would like to know that there's no side action here that's going to come from North Korea if they get into a conflict with China, which very well might happen. And by the fact of doing all this test, and I think the main reason North Korea is doing all the testing is because it's doing a lot of development of new weapon systems, and it wants to make sure they work, and it wants to demonstrate to the world that they work. But the side effect of that is that it puts the United States in a position of having to think twice about. That's why the United States would like to get rid of this North Korean issue before they take on China in any way. I'm sure they'd like to do that, like they want to get rid of Syria and Iran, you know, Syria and Libya before they take on Iran. So there's a lot of things going on in that respect. But, you know, the main reason the North Koreans are doing it, I think, is because they want to develop their systems, and they need to develop their systems, which aren't completely developed. And the United States does need to worry, at least, you know, what we have to take account if we're going to have military action with China. Will the North Koreans come in, and will their missiles be part of the package that we have to deal with in such a conflict?
All right. Final question. Unfortunately, I have so many, but final question, Bill Jones, goes to you. This is an odd request, to say the least, when the U.S. holds China responsible for North Korea's multiple missile launches. It's even asked China and Russia to pressure North Korea to stop. I mean, really? Do you think that the U.S. even... Well, I mean, hey, you got to give it to the U.S. You know, they're asking what they cite as a number one and two national security threats to please do us a favor and stop North Korea from launching these missiles. How do you view that U.S. request from both China and Russia? In under a minute, please.
Well, why would they help the United States in any sense in this issue, when Russia, of course, is under attack by the United States, and where China has been a target of hostility from the U.S., in which the Taiwan issue is now being played with? It's not a situation in which you have a whole lot of trust between these countries.
Okay.
In other circumstances, perhaps there would be cooperation if you're working towards like a security architecture in the Asia Pacific. They would work together. But to the extent that the U.S. has named Russia an enemy and also China as an enemy, you're not going to get too many favors out of them.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg. Jim Cavanaugh, political analyst and blogger from New York. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
From baby formula to medications and childcare, American parents feel strain of shortages. Low-income parents, in particular, may not have the resources to navigate the layered crises. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Throughout wrote in this regard, it's a familiar modern tableau. American parents standing in front of bare shelves where infant formula and children's medications were once stocked. Shortages like these can happen in any given year. But supply chain disruptions and pandemic shopping patterns have caused a confluence of shortages for parents and caregivers. After several difficult years that have unmoored people's professional and personal lives. The formula shortage has been ongoing since February 2022, when a Michigan factory closed down following a recall. Supplies of children's Tylenol and Motrin dropped in the fall when cases of COVID-19, flu, and respiratory virus RSV shot up. That shortage lingers into this year. Adderall, the medication primarily used to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is usually first diagnosed in childhood, is still in shortage. So too is the antibiotic amoxicillin, according to the Food and Drug Administration. For American parents, the mental and emotional load of navigating all these shortages has only grown. Audrey Goodson Kingo, the editor-in-chief of Mother Honestly, a platform for working moms, said, "It's a combination of time-consuming and mentally draining that is putting an amazing burden on working parents. It's a question of, do you want to spend your time or do you want to spend your money? You're going to spend something." Dr. Deborah Greenhouse, a pediatrician in Columbia, South Carolina, has been managing the compounding shortages for a year. It all started with formula and then was followed by the shortage of amoxicillin. When it was clear the antibiotic was in short supply, she started prescribing other antibiotics, Greenhouse said. It becomes a cascade. The more you have to use something different, the more you fall into shortages of all of them, until you get to a point where, literally, it is almost impossible to find children's antibiotic suspensions. And that is still largely where we are now. Her practice has been working to identify pharmacies that are more likely to have children's medicines in stock and are spending paper prescriptions when they can to help parents have something on hand in case they do run across a pharmacy that has the medication their child needs instead of waiting for their doctor to send it electronically. But with Adderall, that's not really an option. The challenge there is heightened because the drug is controlled substance. During the pandemic, relaxed rules allowed doctors to prescribe controlled substances using telehealth, waiving an in-person requirement. That, combined with more attention on ADHD and its symptoms, particularly as parents and kids were at home, led to a rise in the number of prescriptions for Adderall. Higher demand with only limited supply is the perfect recipe for a shortage, and other factors may be at play too, including COVID-19 labor shortages. A shortage of Adderall hurts kids especially. About 10% of children ages 3 to 17 have been diagnosed with the disorder, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. You really do get into this awful situation where you send the prescription into the pharmacy doesn't have it. The parent has to call around and find the prescription and then call us back. We have to send it again. It is incredibly time-consuming, Greenhouse said. I think at the end of the day, the person who is getting the worst of it is the child. It may take days for the family to find it, and the child is struggling in the meantime. Greenhouse's office fields calls from angry parents daily who can't find what they need for their kids. If we spent the amount of time necessary to find all the prescription medications for our families right now, we would never see another patient. We would literally be sitting here all the day on the phone talking to pharmacies, she said. In January, Christian Mariano's two sons were sick at home with a cold and strep throat. At her grocery store pharmacy, she grabbed the last children's pain and fever reducer left on an otherwise empty shelf. Her sister-in-law nurse couldn't find any Tylenol or any other brand for her three sick daughters. A fellow nurse gave her some she had at home. Ever since the pandemic started, obviously, we are all kind of used to random things being out at the grocery store now, including in the medicine aisle. But this was mind-boggling, said Mariano, who lives in New Jersey, adding, the emotional labor has gone into it is definitely very high. Mariano considers herself lucky she was able to find what she needed, but there are families in the U.S. who have neither the means nor the time to drive around from store to store. Their job might not offer that kind of flexibility, or they might not have the resources to spend on gas or purchasing alternates of certain medications. Low-income families are the majority of those who purchase formula, and they have continued to experience the shortage as other parts of the U.S. have rebounded. In the coming months, ease regulations that were put in place to help those families access baby formula with government assistance will expire even as the shortage continues. Greenhouse, the pediatrician, said half of her patient population is on the Medicaid, but and a portion don't have insurance. The families with private insurance and with resources have the ability to get to a pharmacy that's maybe 15 or 20 minutes away. They have the ability to get that medication that has a higher copay, Greenhouse said. Your child who has Medicaid or who has no insurance, if the medication isn't available, they may not be able to get access to the medication that is available if they cannot afford out-of-pocket cost. For people in the bottom 10 to 20th percentile of incomes in the U.S., even having the financial stability to search for alternatives when a shortage does pop up is the first hurdle. Low-income jobs typically offer less schedule flexibility, which parents have relied on to search across cities for medications or baby formula. Those jobs also have fewer benefits like sick leave, which some parents have used to help care for their kids when they were unable to find medications or health insurance, which has helped parents switch to different and often more costly drugs when one is in short supply. There are four people for whom inequality is so deep that the impact of the shortages is more intense. Most of those people are women who make up the majority of low-income workers, and particularly women of color. About 80% of single-parent households are led by single mothers, and more than half are led by Black moms and Latinos. Earlier, Guardian had reported a baby formula shortage sweeping the U.S. that has triggered a political crisis for Joe Biden is continuing to distress parents, caregivers, and medical professionals as they still find the vital product difficult to obtain. Reports of the shortage troubling intensive care units for newborns, as well as creating a black market for the scarce product, are still proliferating across the U.S. media despite a concerted effort at the highest levels of government to get a hold on the crisis. Reports of babies being rushed to emergency rooms after consuming homemade or diluted formulas show the importance of proper nutrition for infants, especially those with special dietary needs.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.